Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. November 8th, general election voting times, locations, and local races. Early voting takes place until Friday, November 4th. Presidio County. Early voting in Presidio County will take place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays through November 4th at the Marfa Visitor Center /USO Building and the Presidio County Annex Building C. Both locations will serve residents in precincts 1 through 7 or all Presidio County residents for early voting. Election Day voting on November 8th will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The Marfa Visitor Center will serve residents from precincts 1 and 7. The Presidio Activity Center will serve precinct 2 voters. The Presidio County Annex Building C will serve precincts 3 and 4 voters. The American Legion in Presidio will serve precinct 5 and 7 voters. Local races. County Judge, Democrat Jose Portillo Jr. versus Republican Cinderella Guevara. County Commissioner, Precinct 4, Democrat David Beebe versus Republican Gary Wilbanks. County Treasurer, Democrat Francis Garcia versus Republican David Chavez. Uncontested races. County Commissioner, Precinct 2, Democrat Margarito Hernandez. Justice of the Peace, Precinct 1, Democrat Dina Jo Marquez. Justice of the Peace, Precinct 2, Democrat Juanita Urias Bishop. District/County Clerk, Democrat Florcita Zubia. Marfa Independent School District Bond. Voters within the boundaries of the Marfa Independent School District will also see a school bond initiative on the ballot, a $57 million proposal for a new K-12 school, career and technology addition to the high school, and other district-wide improvements. The district will raise school property taxes to pay off the bond within a period of 30 years. Brewster County. Early voting in Brewster County will take place at the Judge Val Clark Beard Office Complex, Old Library, 203 North 7th Street, Alpine. Hours will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Tuesday, November 1st, through Friday, November 4th. Remote early voting will take place from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., November 3rd, at the Marathon Community Center for Precinct 3 residents, the Panther Junction Visitor Center, Big Bend National Park for Precinct 5 residents, and J.W. Red Patillo Community Center, Terlingua, for Precinct 6 and 7 residents. Election Day voting on November 8th will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Precinct 1 voters can cast their ballots at the Assembly of God Fellowship Hall, across from Alpine High School, 1802 North Highway 118, Alpine. Precinct 2 voters can cast their ballots at the Judge Val Clark Beard Office Complex, Old Library, 203 North 7th Street, Alpine. Precinct 3 voters can cast their ballots at the Marathon Community Center, 2nd and Avenue E, Marathon. Precinct 4 voters can cast their ballots at the Alpine Civic Center Council Chambers, 803 West Holland, Alpine. Precinct 5 voters can cast their ballots at the Panther Junction Visitor Center, Big Bend National Park. Precinct 6 and 7 voters can cast their ballots at the J.W. Red Patillo Community Center, Terlingua. And Precinct 8 voters can cast their ballots at the Food Pantry of Alpine, 933 East Gallego Avenue, Alpine. Local races. County Judge, Democrat Oscar Cobos versus Republican Greg Hennington. County Commissioner Precinct 2, Democrat Sarah Colando versus Republican Mark Chiles, Justice of the Peace Precinct 2, Democrat Tim Rayeva versus Republican Paul Rashad. There are also Marathon ISD school board members up for election. All other races in Brewster County are uncontested. To view a sample ballot, visit brewstercountytx.com/vote/. Jeff Davis County. Early voting in Jeff Davis County will take place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays until November 4th at the Jeff Davis County District and County Clerk's Office, located in the County Courthouse on 111 North Front Street, Fort Davis. Election Day voting on November 8th will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Precinct 1, 2, and 3 voters will cast their ballots at the Jeff Davis County Community Center, 601 East Cemetery Road, Fort Davis. Precinct 4 voters at the Valentine Community Building, North Main and 8th Street, Valentine, and Precinct 5 voters at the Davis Mountains Resort Baptist Church, 101 Broken Arrow Trail, Fort Davis. Local races. County Commissioner Precinct 2, Democrat Todd Jagger versus Republican Roy Hurley. County Commissioner Precinct 4, Democrat Albert Miller versus Republican Royce Laskowski. All other races in Jeff Davis County are uncontested, including that of Jeff Davis County Judge, in which Curtis Evans, a Republican, is running to continue his role. To view a sample ballot, visit co.jeff-dx.us/page/jeffdavis.elections. City Council approves HOT grants for local organizations and raises utility rates. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. City Council met for a regular meeting last week to approve two new utility rate ordinances, which will allow them to increase customer fees and greenlit hotel occupancy tax, HOT, grant proposals. Mayor Manny Baeza, Mayor Pro Tem Irma Salgado, and council members Raul Lara, Eddie Payares, and Jason Ballman were present. Early in the meeting, council swiftly voted to approve two ordinances, one for new water and sewer fees, another for new natural gas fees, which will allow the city to charge customers more for those utilities. New rates should be reflected in November billing, said City Manager Mandy Roan, in an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel. The profitability of utility services was a major point of discussion in this year's budgeting cycle, with a few city departments losing money on providing the services, which are designed to generate revenue for the city to help pay for other operations. The city is raising rates for water and wastewater, which have remained stagnant since 2015, based on recommendations from a water and wastewater rate study city staff had performed. The city will use the altered rates to help fund local water infrastructure improvements over time, first prioritizing water storage, said Roan. Roan said for now, water and sewer rates were set to increase by 8% each. The need to also increase natural gas rates stems from the fact that the city recently renewed its contract with provider West Texas Gas, WTG, and even though council selected the cheapest of the available renewal options, its new rate, $7.91 per MMBTU is more than double the previous rate of $3.60 per MMBTU. The city will likely pass on this increase to city customers, but Roan said gas usage tends to vary widely between households, and the city was currently unable to provide an estimated average change in natural gas rates. The city is in ongoing legal discussions with WTG relating to a $114,000 bill they received from the February 2021 winter storm. In similar cases in other cities, the cost of the invoice was passed on to customers via an increase in rates, but it remains to be seen how the city and WTG will proceed with the bill. Roan said the city should have an update on the matter in time for the next city council meeting on November 8th. Next, the council voted to approve the city's participation in a group seal coat program for city streets from Park Hill, an architectural and engineering design services company the city has previously worked with. Last year, the city allocated $125,000 to the program, which is just to expand the lifespan of those deteriorating roads, according to Mayor Baeza. Council opted to participate in more seal coating for city streets this year and allocated $150,000 to the program. Lastly, council heard from Director of Tourism Abby Boyd, who also serves on the HOT Grant Committee with Mayor Baeza and Mayor Pro Tem Salgado, regarding HOT Grant recipients for the current cycle. The city gives out HOT Grant money twice a year, and the council approves which organizations get funds based on recommendations from the HOT Committee. This year, the city budgeted to receive $700,000 in HOT revenue. HOT grants given must fall into one of four main categories: arts and culture, advertising reimbursements, sports, and historic preservation. Funds must go to events or activities that promote the local tourism industry. The city budgeted $185,000 this budget cycle for historic building preservation and $41,000 for historic preservation events and programs. Most of the historic preservation money was already spoken for during the budgeting process, with the city allocating money to the Marfa and Presidio County Museum and the Blackwell School, per agreements with those entities, as well as money for historic events, including the Marfa Lights Festival and Janotti Weekend, both circa 1987. Because of this setup, the Friends of the Hunter Gym, a newly formed nonprofit organization looking to restore and preserve the old Adobe Gym on Marfa ISD's campus, was denied a grant they requested for historic preservation for the amount of $35,000. However, the mayor mentioned the city will reconsider the group for funding while planning next year's budget. For arts and culture funds, Ballroom Marfa was awarded $7,500 for their fall exhibitions. Maintenant was awarded $5,500 for current exhibitions. The Marfa Chamber of Commerce was awarded $3,000 for the Marfa Holiday Bazaar. Marfa Live Arts was awarded $500 for its Beyond the Box program and another $500 for its My HEB Partnership project. And Marfa Open was awarded $500 for their Fall Arts Festival. For advertising reimbursements, Ballroom Marfa was awarded $3,500. Cine Marfa was awarded $1,500. The Marfa Chamber of Commerce was awarded $3,500 for the Marfa Holiday Bazaar, and Marfa Live Arts was awarded $2,000 for its Beyond the Box program and an additional $2,000 for its My HEB Partnership project. For sports, The Marfa 100 bike race was awarded $2,000 and an additional $3,500 in advertising reimbursements. After bond reductions, brothers charged in Hudspeth County migrant shooting are released from Tri-County jails. By Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBenSentinel.com. Tri-County, Mike and Mark Shepherd, the Sierra Blanca brothers accused of shooting and killing one migrant and wounding another last month, have once again been released from custody after a district judge agreed to significantly lower their cash bond amounts. The twins face manslaughter and assault with a deadly weapon charges in Hudspeth County, but were briefly held in Tri-County jails last week. At a joint Zoom hearing on Thursday, Mike Shepherd appeared from Brewster County Jail in Alpine, and Mark appeared from Presidio County Jail in neighboring Marfa, sitting silently as their attorneys argued their bond amounts of $250,000 were illegal and oppressive. The Shepherds had already forked over $250,000 apiece following their initial arrest on manslaughter charges in the days after the shooting. They were jailed again on the same bond amounts when hit with the assault charges. Ultimately, 394th District Judge Roy Ferguson agreed to lower those cash bond amounts to $75,000 for Mike Shepherd, the alleged shooter, and $50,000 for Mark Shepherd. The remaining difference in each bond amount, $175,000 for Mike and $200,000 for Mark, were rendered personal recognizance, PR, bonds, which require no money up front. The brothers now await the outcome of a slow-building criminal case. As of press time, over 1 month after the shooting, they had not been indicted. But the hearing provided a first glimpse into the prosecution of the attack that has drawn national scrutiny as a possible hate crime, with immigrant rights advocates and elected officials alike calling on authorities to investigate it as such. An arrest affidavit recounts how, on the evening of September 27th, the brothers pulled over near a reservoir south of Sierra Blanca, where a group of migrants had stopped to drink, at which point Mike, as Mark told investigators, emerged from the driver's seat with a shotgun and fired two shots. A male migrant was struck and killed, while a woman who was shot in the stomach survived. Mark professed they believed they had been shooting at javelinas. At Thursday's hearing, prosecutor Kevin Marcantel stated plainly that he wasn't buying the javelina story. The use of a shotgun indicates they were shooting at close range, he argued. Plus, Mark claimed to have been using binoculars to spot their targets. I can't hardly believe these guys didn't know those were human beings they were shooting at, said Marcantel. I'm really surprised it's not a higher charge than manslaughter, quite frankly. While the brothers' attorneys argued that their clients were not a danger to the public and did not pose a flight risk, offering the testimony of a local bond salesperson and letters submitted by Sierra Blanca residents, Marcantel argued the opposite. He argued forcefully that their actions showed they were a danger and that once an indictment came down, they might be tempted to run. He proposed an evenly split bond at $125,000 cash and at $125,000 PR, less lenient than the judge's eventual ruling. Character testimonies aside, the attorneys argued that their clients were simply unable to pay the full bond amounts. Brent Mayer, representing Mike Shepherd, said his client had no more than a few thousand dollars left in his bank account and that his family was selling a property in Florida in order to cover expenses stemming from the case. Both Mike Shepherd and Mark Shepherd do not have any significant assets in order to post this now second illegal oppressive bond that we're challenging, said Mayer. Richard Esper, attorney for Mark Shepard, said his client had suffered a stroke approximately 9 months ago and has since exhibited early signs of dementia per a recent medical examination in Hudspeth County Jail. His health is not well, he said. Though Esper questioned why the two sets of charges were not filed simultaneously, precluding the need for two arrests, Marcantel explained that the Texas Ranger filing the charges was waiting to see whether the surviving victim would live or die. If she had died, the Rangers would have filed additional manslaughter charges. Once they determined she was likely to live, they filed the assault charges. Esper also insisted, as he has in the past, that Mark Shepard is not guilty of the charges he currently faces, calling the evidence against him extremely weak, even in the law of parties. Marcantel pushed back against that characterization in very strong terms. Mark's the one looking through the binoculars at the alleged javelinas that turned out to be human beings, he said. I think he knew darn well they were human beings. City of Presidio to receive gift ambulance from Winkler County by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio. At last Wednesday's meeting, the Presidio County Commissioner's Court finalized the formal acceptance of a big gift, a new ambulance that will service the city of Presidio. Winkler County had a surplus ambulance and decided to gift the ambulance to Presidio County, which then identified the city of Presidio as the community with the highest need. After years of struggling to keep the city's fleet up to date, the donation was welcome news. Even among the far-flung communities in the Big Bend, Presidio's ambulances have quite a ways to travel. The typical run from within city limits is 88 miles in each direction. Those miles add up quickly, and the city's EMS service frequently deals with breakdowns and other mishaps on the long road to Alpine. The quest for a new ambulance began in 2019 when former EMS Director Melinda Richardson started applying for grants to refresh the city's beleaguered fleet. Years of bad bookkeeping on the city's part bungled her efforts to secure outside funding, and it took a coordinated effort to seek immediate assistance from the Big Bend Regional Hospital District and begin the long, difficult process of addressing the city's troubled financial history. The ambulance donation was coordinated by Precinct 4 Commissioner Buddy Knight, whose nephew is a county commissioner in oil-rich Winkler County. Winkler County has a surplus ambulance, a 2011 International with 40,000 miles on it. Ambulances typically get retired when the odometer hits 100,000, meaning that Presidio will still get plenty of use out of the new unit. Both Presidio City Administrator Pablo Rodriguez and Presidio Municipal Development District Executive Director Jaron Stevens attended the meeting to express their appreciation. As long-term locals, both understood the importance of having an ambulance fleet in good shape. It's a big deal to have ambulance service out here in the middle of nowhere, Stevens said. The county had originally hoped not to assign the ambulance to a specific community and instead use it as a countywide backup that either Marfa or Presidio could use. That idea was prompted in part by talks about developing a region-wide EMS service spurred by the death of former Alpine EMS director Mike Scudder, whose passing left the city to depend on Terlingua EMS for service. The commissioners quickly realized that wasn't an option. Regulations are set by the Texas Department of Health, which stipulates how ambulances are stored, serviced, and maintained. After weeks of discussion, The commissioners agreed that the ambulance would benefit the city of Presidio the most. It's hard for Presidio to keep up with the wear and tear because they just have such a long distance to go to get to the hospital, said County Judge Cinderella Guevara. The donation means that the city will eventually have three functioning ambulance units. One is an ambulance Frankenstein, a box that originally served Terlingua EMS patients, and a new chassis that was funded through grant money. The city of Presidio also ordered a new ambulance with help from the Big Bend Regional Hospital District back in the spring, but thanks to supply chain issues, that ambulance won't be ready to take home until next year. Though a timeline for picking up the ambulance from Kermit has not yet been set, the process should be much quicker and smoother than ordering a brand new ambulance. City Administrator Pablo Rodriguez was thrilled with the news. "It'll make sure that the problems we've had with getting stranded will be lessened," he said. "We'll be able to provide better care for our citizens." The new ambulance isn't all the city of Presidio has to look forward to. Over the summer, the Big Bend Regional Hospital District announced that Presidio would split a $5.5 million grant from the USDA with Terlingua. Presidio's share of the funding will go to creating an after-hours clinic to serve patients evenings and weekends. Presidio County has made really good progress, and we just have to keep working at it, said Guevara.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. Taco Bell and KFC on track for openings, by Sean Yorks. When the combined KFC and Taco Bell burned down in October 2020, Fort Stockton lost two favorite fast food options. The lot has now been vacant for over 2 years, and speculation was rampant about whether the restaurants would return or something new would take its place. Construction began last August, and what once was two restaurants in one building will soon be two standalone buildings with the most up-to-date offerings and service available. Land development lead Larry Rules said Tuesday that the restaurants will open separately over the span of 2 weeks in December. The Taco Bell were pushing for the first week of December. Hopefully the first week the Taco Bell, and maybe a couple of weeks later the KFC. Rules noted last August that the Taco Bell will be the latest Endeavor design, adding that this model looks great, the whole thing is going to look nice, trust me. Taco Bell KFC Regional Director Marlene Fleck told the Fort Stockton Pioneer on Tuesday that they will soon be looking for employees to work in the restaurants. It's going to be a back-to-back opening. It's going to be one individual Taco Bell and one individual KFC, so we'll need a lot of people because I think it's going to be very busy. Fleck said the previous combined location was very successful. We want to be part of the community again, and we want to make it even better than we did before, she said. We want to make an impact in the community. Bids approved for facility repairs, by Sean Yorks. Pecos County recently requested proposals from local contractors for repairs to county facilities in Cayenosa and Imperial. The bids were unsealed on October 24th. One bid for low water crowing repairs on Tipton Road was approved, but the bids from Triple R Welding of Fort Stockton and Basin Roofing and Construction of Midland to repair the Imperial Fire Station, the old community building in Cayenosa, and the Imperial Boy Scout Sheriff's Building were tabled pending warranty information. Both companies submitted bids to replace the metal roof at the Imperial Fire Station, Cayenosa Community Building, and Imperial Sheriff's Office with another metal roof, but both also submitted alternate bids for different materials at the fire station. Triple R presented a bid for TPO roof system, and Basin submitted an alternate bid for a polyurethane roof. The bids ranged in price from $28,800 to $60,300 for the fire station. Triple R had the lowest bids for the community building and Imperial Sheriff's Office, but only Basin Roofing's bids included a warranty. The commission decided to table any action on the bids to ask if Triple R would offer a warranty. The Triple R bid included replacing the roof and repairing interior ceiling water damage. County Judge Joe Schuster said it made sense to table the item based on the difference in price. The commissioners approved the loan bid to repair a low water crossing on Tipton Road. LT Construction of Fort Stockton bid $53,394 to repair the crossing, including 3,400 feet of concrete paving, excavating and removing asphalt and fine grading the existing caliche, among other items. The Commissioner's Court also approved a service proposal from Big Bend Telecom for new phone service, amended service agreements between the county and the fire departments in Sheffield and Ira Ann, and allow Precinct 4 to purchase a John Deere utility tractor and a John Deere Z-Track riding mower. Both are being paid for with budgeted funds. Community, a no-show at Home Rule Charter Town Hall Meeting by Sean Yorks. Early voting is underway for the November 8th general election, and one item on the ballot for voters who reside within the Fort Stockton city limits is whether the city should adopt a home rule charter. A home rule charter takes some power away from the state and gives city residents more of an opportunity to govern themselves. Fort Stockton is the largest city in Texas that has not yet adopted a home rule charter. The city held a town hall meeting October 25th with the city council, city staff, and home rule charter committee members in attendance. Handouts and a video presentation were available to explain what the charter is, what changes would be made to the city, and to answer any questions from the public. The only thing missing was the public. I don't see anybody new out there. Does anybody have any questions? Asked Mayor Chris Alexander after calling the meeting to order. A couple of things I addressed at the last meeting was they didn't really trust what was going on. That's exactly why we're doing this. If you don't trust what's going on, it's a lot easier to make changes with a home rule charter. A charter is essentially the city's governing document. Fort Stockton is a general law city and is regulated by the state. As a home rule charter city, the city and its residents would have more control. A charter is a fundamental governing document for a city in Texas. A charter enables citizens of a city to define the basic organization, powers, duties, functions, and essential procedures of the local government. A city must have a population of 5,000 or more in order to become a home rule city. Home rule municipalities have greater flexibility. This includes, among other things, the number of seats on city council and how they're elected, the apportionment of power between the mayor, the council, and the manager, the duties of administrative staff, including the city manager and city secretary, and the ability for citizens to petition the government to initiate legislation, repeal adopted legislation, and recall city council members. Changing to home rule will not impact daily life, but does impact citizen control over municipal government. If adopted by the voters, the proposed charter would constitute the governing document of the city of Fort Stockton and would govern the city operations, planning, ordinances, and finances. Making the change would assist the city with long-term planning and allow for greater flexibility in funding sources. The proposed charter would also contain limitations on the powers of the city and its elected and appointed officials. Property and sales tax rates will continue to be determined, as they are now, under the state law, by the appraisal district or the city based on valuations and use. Under the new charter, the current process for contesting valuations or utility fees will remain in place. The charter gives citizens the power of recall and referendum, and the Fort Stockton mayor and city council will transfer from 2-year terms to 3-year terms. Dear Editor, recently, in response to a citizen's statement regarding people over the age of 65 and renters, I said, "Those are the people whose kids would benefit the most." I would like to clarify and expand on that statement. First, I apologize if my statement implies that being over 65 and/or a renter equates to poverty. My friends, we live in a great country and a wonderful community. Here, at a minimum, all our kids have access to the same facilities and educational opportunities as provided by our public schools. As a child who grew up poor, I am eternally grateful to the public educators who gave me a chance to succeed and break the cycle of poverty. In fact, I continue paying homage to their memory, having chosen a path of helping others to succeed. I hope you understand that many students do not have both parents at home, and many are not blessed with loved ones capable of providing them with the knowledge or tools to escape poverty. It is because of these realities that our less fortunate students are likely to benefit most from the same services afforded to all. Far too often we take things for granted. Do you remember what the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is? Let me be clear in saying that I choose to fight for all our students, staff, and community members. However, I am most proud of standing for those that need us the most. I hope you can stand with me. Dr. Gabriel Zamora. FSCT to host Story to Health Workshop. A free Story to Health Workshop will be held on Saturday, November 5th from 1 to 3 at the Meeting Hall of Fort Stockton Community Theater. People's stories are a powerful influence on life choices. Sharing personal stories is a way to improve wellness. The theme of the event will be built around experiences of gratitude. As gratitude is a powerful influencer of health backed by tradition and science. The Story to Health Workshop will be facilitated by Dee Hojan, Senior Director of the University of Health Science Center. His division manages the Medicine on the Move program, a mobile health initiative to engage communities for better health. Dee has graduate-level training in pharmacy, public health, and management. Fort Stockton Community Theater recognizes the usefulness, the power, and the value of sharing stories and is eager to host this workshop on November 5th. There's no charge. Registration is not required, but it will be helpful to know how many people to plan for. Call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180 to sign up for the Story to Health workshop to share your stories of gratitude. It's hoped that other workshops can be held to bring people and their stories together. Everyone with a story to tell is invited to attend this active workshop.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 27th. Former construction superintendent blows whistle on bond construction problems. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. A former Lee Lewis Construction Company employee leveled a number of charges regarding ongoing school bond construction projects during the public comments portion of the October 17th school board meeting. Roy Bell said he resigned as superintendent of construction with Lee Lewis, a title he held for the past 2.5 years, about 3.5 weeks earlier. Lee Lewis Construction won the bidding to build the ongoing school bond projects, including a new elementary school and major renovation of the high school and sports facilities. Parkhill Smith & Cooper is the architectural firm that designed the projects. Quote, "Everybody knows me around here," Bell told the group. "I have 46 years of experience in commercial building and have worked on several schools here in Monahans in the past 9 years. I wasn't fired. I quit because I could no longer be part of the deception. I didn't want my name linked to or associated with Lee Lewis or the Parkhill architectural firm," Bell said. While Bell listed numerous specific problems that have arisen during construction, his main charge was there was no one within the school district capable of managing the construction project, which created a situation where there is little meaningful oversight of the general contractor, Lee Lewis, and the architect, Parkhill. Quote, "The architect and the GC, general contractor, will pretty much tell you what you want to hear from them to make money off of it," Bell said. Bell said that school superintendent Chad Smith and support service director Jeff Jones have been the school's representatives during construction and that neither had the knowledge necessary for the job, creating a situation where the school district was at the mercy of the general contractor and architect. Quote, where in Chad or Jeff's resume does it state that either one or combined they have the knowledge to be in charge of $140 million and be in charge of building schools? He asked. Chad and Jeff have missed a lot of construction meetings due to their responsibilities, and it is completely understandable, but these meetings need to have attendance from someone with advanced construction knowledge. I'm not attacking anyone personally, as all the administration and teachers do a very good job in their fields. Construction is not in their field, though. I think Chad would welcome some help, Bell said. Bell told the board that what was needed was a liaison who understood construction to manage the project for the school. He would accept such a position if offered. Quote, I offered my assistance as the liaison to Chad before construction began and was told the board voted against it and there was no help needed. Obviously, there is some help needed. I've built many schools in other cities, and this isn't the way it is done. They always have someone with the background to oversee the construction, he said. Bell noted several specific examples of problems with the project, starting with a mistake in design that would have left the high school unsecured. Bell said he pointed out the problem during his first week on the high school construction project. On the blueprints, there was no solid wall closing in the breezeway between the band hall and the main building classrooms, he said. Bell was told by Lee Lewis and the architect that it would cost the school an extra $750,000 to fix the mistake and was reprimanded by the architect and the president of Lee Lewis Construction for pointing this out to the school officials and offering several ways to solve the issue. Bell was told to keep these things to himself, he said. Quote, I was told to keep this among our team, and our team does not include MWP ISD, Bell said. Another point of contention for Bell is the lack of provisions for handicap ramps between the high school and the existing field house. He said the swimming pool was another example of poor oversight and excessive costs. Quote, the original plans were presented to school officials who were in the position to catch mistakes and request plan changes. They did not do this in a timely manner, causing a 5.5-month completion delay. End quote. Among other things, the number of shower stalls in the natatorium and Walker Junior High field house were not sufficient to accommodate a large number of students having to use the showers in a limited time frame, like getting to their next class. The swimming pool lighting also needed to be changed because the $300,000 lighting cost showed lights installed above the pool where they were not needed. Quote, how could lights above the pool even be changed if they burned out? A ladder can't be set up on the water. The whole lighting cost could have been no more than $100,000, Bell stated. Bell also said phasing of the project was not planned according to the needed school start times either. This caused a skipping around of the construction crews and having to complete phases out of sequence. Quote, I felt like the public has a right to know what is going on and how much money is being spent, in many cases totally wasted. They said our taxes would not go up to pay for the bond, but they increased property values and will bring in more tax dollars, so our tax dollars are involved. I just in good consciousness could not be involved with the deception any longer, Bell said. Council questions status of court filings on properties. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Before Tuesday's regularly scheduled council meeting, a retirement party was held for City Cemetery Supervisor Daniel Hernandez, who officially retired this week after working for the city for 15 years. The council chamber was filled with family members and well-wishers of Hernandez, and everyone in attendance was treated to goodies and punch. Once the council meeting got underway, council members met for a relatively short agenda, and after establishing a quorum and approving previous minutes, members considered approving consent items and a drilling permit from Halcon. While presenting the consent items, Councilmember Calvin Carroll asked City Manager Rex Thee why there was not a code enforcement report submitted for this month. Thee answered by saying, quote, "We did not have a report submitted this meeting because our code enforcement officer has been quite busy and not enough has changed with those who went to court, but we should have one next time," end quote. Code Enforcement Officer Richard Covington also serves as Director of Public Works and carries a heavy workload. Carroll asked Thee what had been done on the four properties the council took note of during the September 13th meeting: 2100 South Betty, owned by Terry Moore; 2101 South Alice, owned by Oval and Ninfa Poros; 1003 South Bruce, owned by Johanna Gray; and 805 East 2nd Street, owned by Sanjo Nunez, all in violation of cleanliness of premises and dangerous structures. The council approved a resolution which would authorize Director of Public Works Richard Covington to send a second notice filing noncompliant cases with municipal court for noncompliance. Covington said, quote, "All four owners came in and submitted a letter stating they would clean up their property and requested more time to get in compliance, and I have agreed to that," end quote. The letters from the property owners submitted to Covington all requested an additional 2 months. Quote, "I'll allow them extra time if they ask for it, because I can't really go up to them and say, get in compliance or else," Covington said. Carroll told Covington, quote, "Well, we can take them to court. It's been 6 weeks since we approved the resolution. I drove by all four locations before the meeting in September, and I drove back by the properties last week, and not a single thing has changed from the pictures you submitted to the council during the meeting. We need to get something done on these properties," end quote. Quote, "If I allow them the extra time, I have to give it to them. Taking them to court now before the extra time I gave them is up wouldn't be the right thing to do," Covington told Carroll. Thee told Carroll, quote, "It's better to do all we can to help the owner get the property into compliance without the city and citizens having to pay to clean it up. If the time comes, we will and do step in. Unfortunately, it does take time to go through the process." Thee also brought up the fact that the city is facing a slight employee shortage right now. Quote, "We recently lost 3 employees and had 2 more retire within the last month. We are doing our best to get people hired, so Richard has been pretty busy lately," Thee said. Quote, "I understand he is overloaded, but I would really like for us to hire a full-time code enforcement officer. That is the only way we're ever going to get a handle on this," Carroll said. Thee concluded by saying, quote, "I do appreciate your concern on the issue. It is tough when you're dealing with people's property and their property rights, but we are not trying to avoid this issue and are working on it and will continue pushing forward," end quote. Along with Thee and Carroll, Mayor Adam Steen and council members Rudy Hernandez, Ivy Valenzuela, and Calvin Carroll were all present for the meeting. Councilman Richard Hawkins was absent. In other business, an oil well drilling application from Halcon Operating Company, Incorporated, for Sealy Ranch 6702H Parnassus Pad was approved. The well is in Winkler County, but actually located inside the city limits of Monahans. The Winkler County land was annexed in the late 50s by the city and serves as part of the City of Monahans Municipal Waterfield. Quote, "We annexed the property in order to have ordinance enforcement control, strictly for the purpose of protecting our water," said Thee. Halcon submitted their application along with the $1,500 fee. Quote, "The land is located about a half mile off the Paiute-to-Wink Highway. Although we are not the surface owners, it is inside the city limits, and this is all required for the protection of our water," Thee added. One arrested after man hit with car during disturbance. The story was read by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man landed behind bars last week after being picked up on a warrant for hitting another man with a vehicle on October 1st. Monahans Police Department officers were called to the 200 block of South Janus around 1:24 a.m. in reference to a pedestrian hit by a vehicle. Upon arrival, Officer Kevin Macias found the 45-year-old victim, Alfredo Padillo, on the ground, covered in debris and suffering from multiple scratches on his foot, arm, and a hurt leg. Criminal Investigation Department Lieutenant Jeremy Kine said, quote, "Officer Macias spoke to the victim, who said the suspect, Amarado Antonio Tejada, age 32, of 2308 West 3rd Street, ran him over as he was leaving his residence," end quote. Padilla further told officers he had been in an argument with Tejada's girlfriend, Melba Acosta, inside the home, which continued outside. Quote, "Tejada went to his vehicle to leave the home as Padilla and Acosta were arguing behind the vehicle, and as Tejada backed out, he struck Padilla," Kine said. By the time officers were called to the scene, Tejada fled in the vehicle. Later that day, at 11 p.m., Acosta called police back to the scene, stating Tejada had returned to the residence in the vehicle. Tejada fled the scene on foot after Acosta called 911, reporting he was at the residence. Officers later located him in the 1800 block of West 2nd Street, he said. Tejada admitted to officers he was on scene at the time Padilla was hit, but that he did not know he was behind the vehicle and didn't know he had run him over. Based on the victim's statements and evidence, an arrest warrant was obtained for Tejada, and he was subsequently arrested on October 18th. Tejada was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. His bond was set at $20,000, and he remains in custody in lieu of posting the bond. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 20 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Early voting brisk in first 2 days. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A steady stream of voters cast ballots at the Ward County Clerk's Office, as early voting will continue until November 4th. As of 9:30 a.m. Wednesday morning, a total of 315 ballots had been cast. Early ballots can be placed at the Ward County Clerk's Office, located on the first floor of the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen. Voting hours are from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Polls will be open on Election Day from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. Polling places by precincts are precincts 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E will cast ballots at the Ward County Event Center, 1525 East Monahans Parkway. Precinct 1W will vote at the Barstow Community Center, 100 East Concho Street. Precinct 3S will vote at the Grand Falls Community Center, 700 North Avenue A. Precinct 4M will vote at the Wicket Community Center, 501 North O'Brien Street. And 4W will vote at the Paiute Community Center, 1108 North Ward Street. On the ballot locally for Ward County are County Judge, District Clerk, Treasurer, Commissioner Precinct 2, Commissioner Precinct 4, Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 and 3, and Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 and 4, although none of which are contested races. The most closely watched race this November is the race for the governor's seat. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is running for a third term and faces Democrat Beto O'Rourke. Statewide, along with the governor's race, the other contested race is for U.S. District 23, where incumbent Tony Gonzalez, a Republican, is facing John Lira, a Democrat, and Frank Lopez Jr., an independent. Texas Senate District 31 candidate Kevin Sparks, a Republican, who claimed that seat with over 54% of the vote during the primary election in March, will also be on the ballot without an opponent, along with the incumbent Brooks Landgraf, a state representative for Texas House District 81.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.